Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Prices start at $9 per month. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This episode is brought to you by the Me, Myself, and AI podcast. Why do only 10% of companies succeed with AI? How can businesses do better? Find out on Me, Myself, and AI. Whether you're an executive, an AI practitioner, or just a curious individual, Me, Myself, and AI delivers approachable and actionable insights for building value and developing competitive advantage. Me, Myself, and AI is a collaboration between MIT Sloan Management Review and the Boston Consulting Group. It's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Jared Bibler, author of the book Iceland's Secret. It's out now. And why Iceland? Well, many people may not know this, but Iceland was kind of the early adopter or the first phase, one could say, of the 2008 and 2009 financial crisis. It is now pretty much forgotten, but there was a run on the banks and you lived through that. And this book details your experience there while in Iceland. You had previously become an Icelandic citizen, right? So you were really there on the inside. Yep. And it's a really entertaining read. And I don't just say that. I sometimes do in these interviews, full disclosure. But this time, I mean it because it really is good. But anyway, the point here, I want to read this part of your book and then I want to ask you some stuff. But it just says the causes of the Icelandic financial crisis of 2006 to 2008 are hardly understood and barely discussed either inside or outside the country even today. That is a mistake. This is a crisis that has clear relevance for every country that practices market capitalism. And these days, that's just about everybody. So let me ask you, what is the relevance today for this Icelandic crisis now almost 15 years ago?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on.
And thanks for coming on.
To get to that, this crisis is often lumped in with the subprime US crisis, which was the final trigger to trigger the complete collapse of Iceland's economy and very nearly the society, very nearly. Quote from the central bank governor of the day, in those days, we're looking at 30 years of anarchy.
Wow.
He said. And I think he was not far off the mark, a very smart politician. It gets lumped in with these other crises that happened in 2008, but the causes of it don't really have anything to do with subprime loans or anything like this. This is kind of a almost cartoonish example of capitalism like turned up to 11. The banks were, as it turns out, they grew from tiny, one is called the Agriculture Bank, one is called the Fisherman, one services the fishermen of the country. Country only had in those days 250,000 people. Today it's about 350. It's growing fast. We have high birth rate. But these tiny banks serving a place probably the size of your neighborhood were able to go, first of all, to borrow on the world capital markets pretty easily and embarked on a program starting in 98 when they were only even partially privatized. The government still owned part of them. Embarked on a program of massive share price buying, massive share price manipulation via the daily buying of their own shares. And they were able to, for 10 years, create a myth of success, a myth of a rising market. And on the back of the share price, on the back of their share buying, they were able to borrow 10x, 20x on debt markets. And for a brief few years, Iceland had this myth, this beautiful prosperity. But in my mind, the whole thing was an illusion. And that's one of the angles I would like people to see when they read the book. It's a great, cute story about a cute place. It's got funny characters and so on. It's kind of liar's poker of the North, if you will. Mm. But at the end, you will be left with maybe a bit of an unsettled feeling about whatever place you're sitting.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. And it gets into this a little bit, but I mean, some of this stuff just sounds kind of like garden variety fraud. I mean, you detail it in the opening chapter of the book that you go through these trades that who was buying the shares of these banks. There were three banks in Iceland that were floated on the exchange, mm-hmm. and find out that it was all being bought by insiders, literally all of it.
It was the bank's own prop desk in each case. Yeah.
Right. And so that's one thing that if you're looking at specifics, prop desks are now outlawed by the Volcker Act, as you know. So maybe not that specific, but what else can you tell us more generally about how these things might be seen and felt today?
Well, the second piece of that, and what was a big mystery to me while I was doing the investigation, is what happened to all the shares that they were buying. Hmm. Each of these banks was huge. They were the size roughly of Enron at collapse. So you can imagine three Enrons collapsing in a place the size of your neighborhood.
Or that was the main float of the stock exchange too.
Yeah, they also made up most of the value of the exchange. And so what I couldn't figure out when I was investigating this is, where did the shares go? Because the prop desk would be accumulating hundreds of millions of dollars worth of shares each quarter. But then when you look at the audited financials, they were not there. Hmm. Should have been sitting in treasury stock for the company. They weren't there. So I actually didn't believe my eyes at first. I thought we were missing some trades and so on. What it turned out was that they were always on Enron style. They were unloading them at the end of the financial quarter. And the buyer would be some companies that you've never heard of, like Holt Investment Group or DeSulo Trading Limited. And here's where this kind of connects to the Pandora Papers, which just came out, I think, 10 days ago. These were all offshore entities, usually. And they would buy in one trade $200 or $300 million worth of shares in this Icelandic bank. Hmm. And this would be an offshore entity that was newly created. Maybe it was 2 weeks old. And so where do you think the offshore entity got the money to buy $200 million worth of shares? The bank's loan book, because banks make loans. Yeah. So effectively they became...
So it's kind of like an internal Ponzi scheme.
Yeah. And as long as they could keep that share price looking healthy, they could go and raise capital on the debt markets, which was much more than the size of the share price manipulation. So as long as they could trick with the share price was key. If they could keep that where it was, then they could go and borrow huge amounts. And so I think there's a metaphor here for our world. I mean, this is, as I said, this is taken to the wall. This is the extreme example, but it's quite unsettling how this went on. And also the fact that I had to write this book for you to even know this story.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't know that there were three Enron collapses and it was all 10 years of fraud behind it. Nobody wanted to talk about that. Mm.
But interesting, one of the differences between Iceland and the US, at least, is that some of these individuals and actual individuals were brought to justice on this, right? By the regulators in Iceland, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's not something that we did here.
That was a big part of my work. As I say in the book, I discovered that trading pattern early on in my... I was hired by the regulator just a few months after the collapse. And things were so desperate there. We were eating like horse meat sausages. And that was a dark time. We didn't have enough to eat. And the supermarkets were going a little bit bare. And... there were ads on TV telling people to try to spend their money on products from Icelanders to try to keep the economy. I mean, it was dark. Mm. And it was also winter in Iceland, which is very dark. But when I came to the regulator, I was lucky in that I got a tip on this trading pattern, started investigating. But very quickly, the people above me and the regulator wanted me to stop that investigation. So I had uncovered that at the biggest bank, two prop traders were buying up many days, 100% of the market volume, or 70 or 80% of the market volume on their own books. And when I took that to my boss with all all the research done. She said, great, let's write it up and send it to the prosecutor. And I said, like, do you mean to tell me that this 25-year-old kid, you know, spent a billion? Because in the last year, this bank spent $1.25 billion buying its own shares in Iceland and Sweden. It's like, do you mean to tell me that, you know, this is like massive fraud, right? And I said, do you mean to tell me that this one or two prop traders spent $1 billion of the bank's money and like none of their bosses? Like, and she's like, okay, you have a week, Jared. And so I had to figure out how to get emails from the bank and read them. And then in the emails, it showed the pattern. The pattern went all the way to the CEO and the chairman of the board. They were managing this process for years. So I think that, so my goal was to make the biggest case I could. The country was really demanding it. People were on the street every day in front of parliament, banging pots and pans and starting fires. And it was just very ugly. I wanted to try to make the biggest case I could to, you know, to show that we could move forward from this. But there's a lot of pressure to not. And then I was only the beginning of this. Then it went to the special prosecutor who was a new office. And he really also went hard and went full steam and tried to go after the top people. So these were all choices we made. And I think we only had the window to do that for a couple of years because we had political will from the people demanding that. But as you see in the book, by the end of 2011, me and my team is just shut down. The window was closed. And even though we had only investigated maybe 5-10% of the crimes that we had started to find. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about how this worked. I mean, it sounds a little bit kind of almost Bush League, at least by
present, it is,
right?
It
by
is.
Present day standards. Yeah. I mean, you would think that the high actors in finance have more sophisticated ways of covering their tracks. But the use of these offshore accounts is something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting. I keep thinking about China when we talk about this, because there's a lot of else talk about capitalism on steroids. I mean, this is capitalism on steroids with like testosterone injections and all kinds of stuff.
Right. Right.
And who knows exactly what the companies there are doing and what the stock exchanges are doing.
Yep.
There's a lot of stuff, but maybe that's a topic for another day. But I am curious, like, what you think, how this could play out in the present day, maybe if it's just in Iceland or anywhere else.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
So I've also been involved in regulation in a couple other places, and everything I've seen unfortunately points to this, maybe not as crazy and as Bush League in your words as what happened in Iceland, but this type of corruption is fairly endemic in the markets of the world. And if you think about it, it makes sense, because the incentive for someone who's for these prop traders in Iceland, let's just take them as an example, or for the executives in Iceland, prop traders made a great salary and all they had to do was just push the buy button every day. So they were happy. And the executives, they were paying themselves salaries and bonuses that had never been seen before in Iceland. And on the other side, who's going to stop this? You have regulators who are paid much less, who are hoping to get a job at the same bank, hoping to upgrade their role. So they're not going to go too hard after this. And in no country that I know of does a regulator get a personal bonus for bringing in a big case, right? So it's complete mismatch of incentives. And I think that, and with no prosecutions for years in most countries, I think this type of thing is rampant.
Yeah, and it will probably take another crisis for us to realize just how rampant it is.
And I think that next crisis will make 2008 look like a walk in the park. Fortunately,
that's heartwarming. What? Okay, so now what makes you say that? Like, what?
But look, everybody, like they say, you have this. I can't remember which behavioral bias this is, but because I've been through the experience of losing everything, and I know how that feels. Not only could we not feed ourselves, but we couldn't afford our house anymore. We had to hand the keys back. And most Icelanders did. So we lost our house, our pension funds in Iceland had been invested in those in those banks. So those were wiped out. And our savings was either, our savings was in money market funds, which supported the buying of those shares. So it's horrible to lose everything when you're already in your mid 30s. You know, you will never recover that, which, you know, the savings that you had early in life. So that, I'm probably biased to thinking this will happen again and to seeing signs of it everywhere. And I hope I'm wrong, really.
Yeah. I think confirmation bias might be the thing that you're talking about, but it doesn't change the fact that, yeah, these issues are probably endemic. I mean, you know, we do have some better regulations. I mentioned the Volcker Act.
Yep.
And again, in the US, at least it's.
But I haven't followed that closely, but that wasn't getting rolled out very quickly the last I checked.
No, I'm sorry. I think it's called the Volcker Rule. Dodd-Frank is the act, and Volcker is part of that. The Volcker is the one that separates, or made all the banks spin off their prop desks.
But did they actually? Because
I think they did. They did. Okay. The big ones in the U.S. did. This is goes back to the early parts of the 2010s was when they were doing all that. And at the time, I was following it pretty closely, so I'm pretty sure they did. Wow. Okay. So, and it is interesting how, you know, you experienced something that nobody in the U.S., at least I shouldn't say nobody, they could have, but most Americans, you know, have only read about in books like yours, which is a run on the banks, civil unrest, and literally having trouble putting food on the table to the point where you have to, eat horse sausages.
Yeah,
which from your description in the book sounds awful.
Yeah, they're not very good. But
yeah,
what was interesting, some of my friends just finished the book recently and they said, oh, we didn't realize how much you suffered in those years. And I think Iceland was a country that was starving for centuries. And so it was interesting how people snapped into this survival thing and they knew how to do it and get through those few years. But that was very dark. And a lot of people like us ultimately moved away. Especially if you didn't have kids yet, it was just a no brainer there was like a brain drain in 2014, 15, 16. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. But yet now Iceland is kind of okay again, right? I mean,
well, it's okay if you like to walk downtown in your town and every store is selling t-shirts and stuffed puffins.
So as a tourist,
it's become like a Caribbean island where, you know, cruise ships pull up, dump off a bunch of low dollar tourists. And it makes me very sad to go there. I worked really hard to learn Icelandic and now I can't even speak that language on the main shopping street of Reykjavik because even they've had to import people from other countries to work at the shops to handle. Yeah, you have 10 tourists per person per year. So the downtown, all the nice neighborhoods have become Airbnbs, pushing people out to the suburbs, which are not very nice. And it's lost the soul to my eye. I love to go there. I miss living there. But when I go there, it's always a bit hard.
Wow. Okay. But I guess the point is that, you know, no, in the U.S., we haven't really seen anything like this. The Depression, we did. And it's something that, you know, you do have to, I mean, the chances aren't zero that this type of thing happens, regardless of confirmation bias or whatever. But it doesn't necessarily mean they're high. But this is the type of thing that, you know, you have a whole prepper community. You have people, a lot of whom have been banking on this for a very long time. So what kind of stuff did you experience in this? And one of the things is I'm curious about is what, like the currency collapse too, right? The Icelandic krona. So what would you guys do at the height of this thing for buying goods and stuff?
Well, that's why the supermarket shelves started to go dry. So just to give you some numbers, for a long time, it was about 80 to 90 ISK would buy you 1 euro.
Right.
And against the dollar, it would be like 70.
Yeah.
And as the crisis hit, there was one day where suddenly against the euro, it was 130. Mm-hmm. So it goes from 90 to 130 in a couple of days. And then within a few days after that, it went to 340 to the euro. And then they just froze. What they do is they just freeze trading. So you can't buy euros anymore. You can't buy dollars. You can't buy hard currency anymore. The only way to buy it would be to show a valid flight ticket that you're going overseas. And then you
are allowed. That sounds like Venezuela. Yeah.
Yeah, that's how it was. Then you're allowed to buy up to, I think it was a couple hundred dollars. It wasn't even that much. And I actually went out of the country during the crash about a week after, because I was just like, what are we going to do? And I actually, and there was nobody flying at this point because things were in such chaos. I got a cheap ticket to France, mainly to just go to the ATM every day for a few days and try to take out euros. But when I was leaving to go to France, I had my flight ticket. I went to every bank in the downtown. I went to 10 bank branches, and they even had paper signs in the window, like no euros. So even with a ticket, they were cleaned out. And that's frightening, you know, to not know how much the money in your wallet will buy the next morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is interesting though. But the point here is, sorry to kind of make things
sure. So bring me back.
Yeah. But the point is, like, if you study these collapses of society, and, you know, as a contrarian investor, you do, like I said, you have to keep this stuff in mind a little bit, at least in the back of your mind. That is what happens is it does the run on the banks and a run on, there is a run on hard currency. I haven't, from what I've read, which is admittedly not that much, it doesn't seem like there's been a move to physical gold and things like that. I have heard of people exchanging jewelry and stuff, like during World War II in Europe, for example, but still that was to get hard currency. So it does sound like hard currency is a pretty good disaster hedge, especially if it's dollars or euros or francs, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
That's, so, yeah.
I moved to the hard currency capital of the world, you know, I mean,
yeah, you're in Zurich. Yeah.
All of my investment decisions changed, including that I own gold now. I own silver.
You do.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. I think when you live through that, it scars you.
Sure. Interesting. Wow.
It also means that I missed out on the bull market of the last 10 years.
Right.
Because I was just like, I don't trust this, you know. Mm-hmm. It was quite scarring. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is interesting, which is another thing that didn't really happen here. You have some people, it seems like the crises here, at least in my lifetime, have all been so short-lived. Like we had the late 90s tech bubble, and that had an ugly landing. And for a couple of years there, it seemed like tech stocks were never going to happen again. And then you have a Google IPO. I remember the Google IPO in 2004, and I was like, why are people buying this? Don't people learn? Well, Google is a solid company, unlike some of the dot-coms that are being propped up. But the point is, you know, 10 years later, now we did have another run in tech shares here, which some would say is over. Some would say it's not yet. It seems to be catching its breath a little bit, but people, at least here, don't really have those, haven't really, I mean, some have, maybe, but you don't really hear about them. I mean, all you see is that, like, all this money going into risk assets and, dare I say, cryptos, which is like the most risky of the risky things one would think, because it's not backed by anything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with you there. And I think it's also kind of ripe for fraud, this crypto world.
Yeah.
It's another Wild West. Have you been following the Tether story?
No.
Okay.
No. What is that? I should know.
One of the best reviews I have for the book so far is a journalist who's a crypto bro. So Tether, I'm not an expert. I was just reading about this because I'm curious. Tether is a so-called stable coin. It's supposed to be backed one-to-one. So it's something that is on the blockchain, but it's supposed to be one Tether is $1.
Right.
And this year or recently, they've sold $69 billion worth of new Tethers.
Mm.
And nobody knows if they actually are holding dollars behind those or not. And they can't seem to find it where they're holding the money.
Yeah, that's not very good.
And so there's actually different theories on what they're doing. It seems like they invested some of it in Evergrande. which is crazy. But
okay,
they seem to have given loans to Chinese property companies. That's one thing. There's a big Bloomberg piece on this from like last week. And okay. The other thing they do is they use tethers to buy bitcoins, and they like lever themselves up by, so they're holding bitcoins as collateral against the tethers that they issue. Nice. So they're not just taking dollars and holding them. They're issuing new tethers against Bitcoin, and they're hoping Bitcoin doesn't go down too much.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like a shell, like a house of cards that's going to come apart. But
yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So physical currencies, dollars, euros, Swiss francs, which you now have a lot seeing how you're living in Zurich, gold and silver, physical or ETFs?
Both. Okay. But you have to be careful on the ETF. Holding. I think something called PSLV. That's a silver ETF that I think that's Canadian based, but they supposedly hold physical.
Right.
And in Switzerland, we have some ETFs that claim to hold physical one-to-one.
Right. Okay.
They're 95% physical, basically.
Right. Okay.
But some of the popular ETFs are not, and they're holding just paper claims, what's called unallocated gold and silver.
I see. You're right. Right. Yeah. We had a whole show on this actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not a whole show, but yeah, but, that's interesting.
What's crazy about that is apparently there's a hundred ounces of unallocated gold for every physical ounce of gold. Mm-hmm. And in silver, it's 500 to 1.
What does that mean?
It means, if you call your bank and say, I want to buy silver, and they say, oh, we'll hold that for you. They say that they're holding silver for you. What they're holding is a claim on silver, which is unallocated, meaning that there's no serial number bar behind what they're holding for you. They'll just get it for you. If you're big enough to demand it, they'll get it for you.
When you ask for the delivery of it.
When you ask for delivery. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That could be a problem if people actually do start to make a run for that. Huh. All right. What else? What are your thoughts on real estate? It sounds like, I mean, that's also something that was a big problem in the last crisis.
I think if you have land in a desirable location, that's never a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cool. In Iceland, what happened to us, this is just maybe a fun story, not fun for us, but what happened to us with real estate is that in Iceland, and this may have changed a bit, but I think it's basically the same today. The mortgage you would get for a house or an apartment purchase is what's called inflation linked.
Yeah. You go into this in the book. Yeah. Go on. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you may have 20-30% equity in your house. And then you wake up one day and the currency has collapsed. Inflation goes then through the roof. And then then you're underwater on the mortgage because the principal balance will tick up each month with inflation.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's not great. Luckily, we don't have that here. Do you know of any other countries that do?
No, Iceland, I think, is the country that has embraced this craziness the most.
They still have it now?
Yeah, I think there's some options that you could have a non-inflation linked mortgage. But then in that case, I believe you could only get a 5-year mortgage, and then you have to roll it, at whatever the new interest rate is after 5 years. Yeah.
Wow.
I haven't dealt with Icelandic property since 2012.
Yeah,
not an expert on that, but they love this inflation indexing, and to my mind, it's obviously just building inflation right into the gears of the economy.
Yeah,
because every corporate loan for a while, every corporate and personal loan, and even car loans, were either inflation linked or foreign currency, which is the same thing. Mm. You borrow either hard currency or you inflation linked. Domestic currency. Yeah. This is the same thing.
Yeah.
And so that's just feeds. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So anyway, there's a lot of lessons here. I want to take a short break and then come back and ask you some more questions about this, some more questions about the book, some more questions about your views on current markets and what you're doing. But let's first take a break. If you are a premium subscriber, do not touch the dial because you will not get the break. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. To become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast. where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host and access to private channels on our Discord server. They also get generous discounts to our virtual conferences and other services. And of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information. That's contrarian.supercast.tech.
Stock market hats claim to be stylish and funny. Some of them say things like end the Fed, don't tax the rich, I heart the Fed, Dr. Parikh Patel, not back office. Okay, that one is actually kind of funny. Market cap cap, that's also pretty funny. And some other ones. You may know their Twitter, at Stock Market Hats, but check it out, stockmarkethats.com, and enter contrarian at
checkout. All right, Jared Bibler, we're back. 10% discount. And this is the segment of the show where we like to ask our guests a little bit more about themselves and how they came to their current station in life. Your book gets into this a little bit. I believe you hail from Boston, or at least that's so. But yeah, talk us through this, and maybe you can get briefly into what brought you to Iceland. The book goes into that as well, and how you find yourselves now in Zurich. Go ahead.
How much time do you have, Nathan?
Well, you know, Cliff's Notes version.
Okay, I was born in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I grew up in a very working class town near Boston. When I tell people here I'm from Boston, they say, "Ooh, so nice," but it was not nice. The windows of my elementary school were smashed and never fixed. And yeah, it was not great. But somehow I got out of there and I got into MIT, which was kind of a miracle in itself. And that was kind of set me up to maybe a different trajectory in my career. I ended up on Wall Street, but not flashy Wall Street, Wall Street back office. So there was a small firm in Somerville, Massachusetts, still there, called Galatea. And we were hired by one of the biggest Wall Street banks to build their global back office out. So the founder of our small firm had come up with this grand unified theory of securities settlement. It was beautiful and brilliant. And it was a model that worked in every market in the world. So I was rolling that out in Tokyo and in New York. And I saw the beginning of the mortgage boom because one of the products that I was transitioning onto that system was mortgage backs, as they say in Brooklyn. And when they answer the, I love this, when they answer the phone, they say mortgages. I missed that. And actually the book, it got cut, but the book used to begin on Wall Street. It used to begin with my main client contact was a guy called the Hammer. And everyone called him that and everybody feared him. And he had worked his way up from, I think he maybe finished high school, but he was a messenger.
Yeah.
And he worked in those days, you could do that. He worked his way up to head. He was heading US Treasury settlements, all Fed settling products. His team was moving like $1 trillion a night. Yeah. And so that was really cool, but exhausting. I was burned out. I did that for 5 years. We converted all these old systems into our nice new system. I was really burned out. I had gone on Iceland on a vacation and I stumbled into an opportunity there to do the same thing in Iceland, but with an Icelandic salary, which was like almost a 50% pay cut, but with Icelandic hours, which was like super nice. I mean, you go in, it's different culture than America. You go in and you work hard. Nobody's like talking at the foosball table or not so much of that. You work and then you get up from your desk at 4 or 5 and you leave. Mm. And so that was when I moved there, that was a revolution. I was just planning to be there 1 year. Mm. And when I moved there, I just loved the life so much. Mm. They have swimming pools in every neighborhood. I would go and they're open all year. It doesn't matter.
I was going to say, you can use them. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Because and the winters there are pretty harsh.
Yeah. And they're geothermally heated. So you can sit outside in a hot tub after you swim some laps. You can sit in a hot tub after work. And everybody does this.
Nice.
It's really nice. And so those were wonderful years, and that was the boom. So I experienced the Icelandic craziness. I wasn't that much a part of it, but then later I got hired as an asset manager by one of the Icelandic banks. Actually, that is in the book. And then I was shocked by some of the things we were doing with customer money. I ultimately resigned there, and it was 6 months of that crisis winter. I didn't have a job. And my fiance was keeping the household together with her new job, but we didn't have a lot. And we didn't have access to our even to the money that we had in the bank. So then I was hired by the regulator, and I started these huge investigations of the crisis in April 2009.
And that took you mentioned in 2011, 2012, that whole thing was ended by the government.
2011, it just, because I didn't even get a team to help me until 2010. I did the first year and a half of investigation solo, more or less. And then I got like five or six people on my team, which was really nice. And then I was like, okay, now we can go. Now we have 5 years of work to get this done. But within another year, it was like, okay, we've done enough of that. It's time to look to the future. And then I worked briefly for the special prosecutor in Iceland. But since many of his cases had come from me, I was really conflicted. I couldn't work on anything, basically. So then we decided to move to Switzerland and try to have a better life.
And what prompted that? I mean, why Switzerland of all? I guess other than the hard money.
Mountains.
Okay.
I like to ski and to paraglide. And so it was the obvious choice.
Nice.
So,
so you've been there since when?
I've been here since 2012.
Oh, wow. So a good stretch.
Yeah.
And now how have you been spending your days since then? Other than writing the book, I guess.
Writing the book was a good 24 month project. And now I have my own small consulting company. I've been advising on investigations and also on, and this is funny. I don't know if you know about this in America, but there's this new sustainable finance world.
Oh yes. She's sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, there's a lot of overlap, I think, in the financial fraud and this greenwashing idea. Did you see the news about DWS, the Deutsche Bank?
Yes. Not surprising. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So I've been getting hired on a lot of sustainable finance gigs, and I may soon be going into one of the Swiss banks as an internal person on anti-financial crime.
Oh, wow. Jeez. Yeah. Yeah. Yikes.
I was also one of the, I had a brief stint at the Swiss Stock Exchange. I was in charge of market surveillance and enforcement for the exchange here. But I feel maybe I was a little too hardcore. I didn't last very long there.
Okay.
So,
I mean, that kind of begs the question, what areas you think, you mentioned ESG. If there's any others that you think could be, and we talked about cryptos before, that could be rife with fraud, or I guess potential proving grounds for this type of stuff.
This is not a secret, but here in the Swiss stock market, at least when I was there, and this was true before I was there, we were sending about one insider case per week to the authorities. So to the FINMA and to the
insider trading.
It's big, especially on, I was thinking about doing like an academic paper on this. It's big because it usually makes economic sense to do it, or when it makes economic sense to do it, people do it. And I'm thinking in terms of M&A type situations.
Oh,
so I saw a scenario where a small-ish company, and it's especially in the more thinly traded companies. It's easy to do. Someone invested seemingly $5 million over several months and got the value of the shares up by 30%. And then they made a shares for shares offer for a competitor in a merger. And based
That's intricate. Okay.
Yeah. But if you thought you weren't going to get caught, you might I mean, I might do the same, right? I wouldn't, I don't think I would do it, but the person saved maybe 40 or 50 million in the merger.
Sure. Sure.
So we did some, you know, so who wouldn't take that? And especially if you know, and you know, the thing that I learned, I was quite naive when I started the market, market surveillance job. There's back to incentives. If a market, London or Frankfurt or here or New York, if a market would get super clean, would really go after everything, companies are going to start listing elsewhere. So there's kind of no percentage in, it's great to have a certain number of cases and press releases, but underneath the markets are pretty dirty.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's not much incentive to clean that up.
Yeah. 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 Although, I mean, if the US were to do it, we're really to lead with that stuff, then
The US is the home of the biggest tax havens in the world, for example.
Yeah, right.
Getting back to that topic, you know, you have the president's home state is Delaware. That's everybody. The Economist wrote about this 10 years ago, how this was the world's biggest tax haven. So I don't see much coming out of there.
I guess I was talking more about securities regulation, but that's a whole nother thing.
On the securities side, like the SEC puts out a lot of press releases. But if you dig into the details of the cases, they're often quite small potatoes.
They're tiny. Like, I know, I've done that.
$20,000 insider. I said, come on, man.
Yeah,
Iceland, by the way, any insider case below $500,000, we definitely did not have the resources for post crisis. And even the ones over that amount, the bigger cases, we probably had 20 or 30. And when the team got taken apart, most of those were just.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Jim Rickards, you may know him
The name. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. He said, and others have said this too, that there is basically insider trading is rampant and always has been.
Yep.
And that if you look at M&A, like there are just so many people that are in the know.
Yes.
Be it lawyers, bankers. Okay. Yeah. They have, you know, they're all sworn to, you know, NDAs and stuff, but you know, it doesn't take much to tell somebody somewhere, tip somebody off. And, you know, so which is why you see all these bids happening, which is why you have things like expert networks. Right. I mean, not only, but, yeah. So, and then biopharma is another one. These trials, you'd think the results would kind of be out there a little bit. Although that seems a little bit, for whatever reason, those don't move as much as M&A deals. Like in M&A deals, you can almost always trace it earlier to when it was announced, right?
Yeah.
So something's going on there. Yeah.
When I was doing surveillance, you can often see the big trades the day before.
Yeah,
they're so obvious. There was one where there was a deal and the stock price jumped. Or no, I think it was bad news. I think this was not a merger. This was the other thing you'd see is when there's bad or good news in the
right. Place. Sure, sure. Yeah.
And there was a, I think it was a case of bad news, and someone had dumped 50,000 shares the day before through a broker who had never traded that share. You know, so. These things are easy to find and they should be easy to prosecute.
But, right. I guess it all depends where you want to start. And if you see it, like you said, like the cases they do bring are relatively small potatoes. So you left Iceland, obviously, about 8 or 9 years ago. And, but from what you've seen, like you said, you're still in touch with a lot of people in Iceland. And you still go there, and your wife is from there, right? So, how has that country changed in the last since you were there during the crisis?
Well, we talked about the tourist explosion, so that's probably the main thing. But what really frightens me is that nothing has changed in terms of the business landscape. So, there's been a bunch of big news pieces about me and about this book in the last few weeks, and it's caused some controversy. Publicly. And then I've gotten a lot of private support on people calling me. And one person who I worked with very closely for about 3 years, he called me 2 days ago and he said, I love your book. And I'm so glad you told this story. Nobody had told it before. And he said, Jared, I'm afraid that we're back in 2006 or seven again. He said, we have a lot of new listings on the market. I believe all three of the banks, the same banks, by the way, they changed their names. It's like Spinal Tap, changed their names. And now they're back on the market again. And he said, I don't know who's buying or investing in these shares, who's creating the volume. He said, I won't put my own money in this market. By the way, he works now in one of the banks, compliance. He said, I won't put my own money into this market. But of course, by law, his pension fund that he's legally mandated to be in has to be. So that really scares me.
That's pretty terrifying. So they haven't put any safeguards in place? Like, I mean, they must have separated the prop desks, at least, like the Volcker type thing that we talked about.
I should know that answer, and I don't. However, what I can tell you, the thing that scares me the most is that, like I said, we built up two investigation teams post-crisis, and they got up to 17 people, and these were great. We had our pick of the best people in the country, and I would submit that these were some of the best teams at this type of investigation in the world, at least at that time. We were fantastic once we got going, and that was all taken apart in 2011. And they did nothing to create an enforcement capability at the regulator since.
Okay.
So, I mean, almost every country has an enforcement part. The reason that's important is at the regulator, you have people who are calling the same bank every day to get info. And you don't want that person to then be prosecuting or investigating a case against someone. They need to keep a good relationship. They need to be able to toss something suspicious over the wall to their colleague to pick up. And so US has this, Germany has it, UK, Switzerland, everybody has this. Iceland still does not have it. Mm. And that is, that's the most frightening to me.
Wow. Yeah, that is pretty disconcerting. All right, cool. Jared Bibler, maybe in closing, we can tell listeners how to find the book, how to find out more about you. Are you active on the social media at all?
My best social media now is actually LinkedIn. So you can find me there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I relaunched my Twitter account, but it's not much happening over there right now.
Oh, really? Okay, that's too bad.
You could, I mean, I tweet, but I don't know if anybody reads it.
I'll follow you. What's your Twitter?
It's Jared_Bibler.
Oh, that's easy. Okay.
And the book website is icelandssecret.com. You can
order. That's a good one. Okay.
You can order the book on there. It points you to Amazon or wherever you'd like to order it. So
very cool. Are you planning a book tour of the United States anytime soon?
I really want to do this. And my publisher said, oh, nobody does that anymore. But
yeah,
that would be so cool.
Pandemic, probably people don't do it. Yeah.
But maybe I'll come to Boston and do a signing at Barnes & Noble or something. I have a friend who works there. So yeah.
Oh, great. Very good. All right, Jared Bibler, thank you so much for coming on the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. Thank you all for being with us and for listening. And with that, we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.